Thank you, Dr. Haken. Before I begin, let me say a word about the artwork that was used in the conference poster. I'm not sure if you noticed that. They are newly commissioned portraits of Calvin and of Verrey. I don't know if you've ever seen Calvin with blue eyes, but that was the way they initially did that portrait. And they changed it to light brown later on. The Pierre Verrey Association and Zurich Publishing, the president of both, being Tom Ertl, commissioned these portraits. They're very, very good. What they would do is they took all of the known portraits that had been done in the past, he put them up, as well as with measurements from models to get the correct proportions of face and shoulders and neck and collars and so forth, and we have completely new portraits of them. And they have graciously allowed them to be used in our conference marketing posters, the first time publicly for use. So thank you very much publicly to them for letting us do that. They also published the only recent work on, I'm a librarian, so I bring books with me, right? That's what I do. The only recent book on Verrey that I know of by Jean-Marc Berthoud. It's a good book. I have issues with it, but it's largely good. And we can talk more about that later if you wish. I will try to save time for questions at the end. If I don't, throw something at me so I stop. You lie! The cry echoed through the chamber as the political speech made claims that others clearly saw as false. In this case, however, the speaker was a Giuliani. Michel Giuliani, a Catholic friar with a scholarly reputation, preaching during Lent in the Swiss village of Orb at the foot of the Jura Mountains in the spring of 1531. Giuliani is said to have preached against the nascent Reformation harshly, with invective, and the documents say, with both hands. He would often inveigh against those who were too few in number to resist. They would sit quietly and endure the sermonic tongue lashings with but a quivering whisper of outrage. On this day, Giuliani was speaking about those nuns and monks who had left their vows and chosen to marry. He asked, "Do you think that they have a legitimate marriage?" "No. They are vile and filthy, abominable apostates before God and men." He preached. But Christopher Houllard, a Reformation sympathizer whose brother John had recently converted, left his priestly vows and married, upon hearing this condemnation, rose sharply where he was and cried out, "Giuliani, you lie!" And immediately, a crowd rushed upon him and beat him right there in the church. Orb was under the military and political protection of Bern at the time. And so in order to gain control over this quickly escalating event, they decided to send a deputy of sorts to help quell the situation. Enter William Farrell. Farrell was a Frenchman, born into nobility in 1489 and appointed to the faculty of the University of Paris in 1517. So you had two people at the University of Paris preaching justification by faith, Jacques Lefebvre d'Etaples, as well as Farrell, the same year that Luther nailed his theses to the wall in Wittenberg. He was a disciple of the famous French humanist Jacques Lefebvre d'Etaples, whose humanist impulses were drilled into Farrell such that the two fed each other's inquisition of theology and tradition. He has been characterized as a fiery, red-headed bull in a china shop, more at home as thunder in the pulpit than as scholar with quill, though I think that should be challenged somewhat. At any rate, after fleeing Paris, he initially landed in Basel, where he immediately fell in with theologians such as Ecolampadius. He was never one to grow roots too deeply in any one place, and found that his gifts were best suited for preaching tours, a realization that just happened to coincide with a very public feud with Erasmus, who could not stand Farel. After some amusing name-calling, Farel called Erasmus a Balaam, and Erasmus called him, well, let's say boys will be boys. After some amusing name-calling, Farel would make his way to Zurich to visit with Zwingli, to Wittenberg to visit with Luther, to Strasbourg to visit with Bucer. And when he tried to make his way back to Basel, he found himself lost in the rain on a cold, dark night, only to find Basel battling an outbreak of the plague when he did arrive in his weak state. And Erasmus made sure that his efforts were to no avail upon his recovery, so Farel gives up in Basel and decides to go join the reform movement in Bern. So when the opportunity came for him to go on preaching tours throughout the Vaud, Neuchâtel, Aigle, Yverdon, and Orbe, he jumped at the chance. Farel's approach at reform was more pastoral and more thoughtful than that for which he is often given credit. As early as 1525, while still in Paris, he began to relate true piety and pastoral intention with the purpose of church discipline. His 1525 summary and brief exposition had a chapter on excommunicality in which he includes an extremely gracious explanation of the circumstances in which someone should be excluded from the table of the Lord's Supper. But the longest chapters by far in that 1525 document are those chapters given to his exposition and defense of marriage and the instructional responsibilities inherent in child-rearing. He relays a genuine concern for the institution of marriage, of the necessity of a husband's love for his wife, fixation on the Word of God, the need for unity between husband and wife, and then he gives a brief glimpse into the relationship between this honorable and affectionate view of marriage and the presence of church discipline. So as early as 1525, Farel is beginning to lay a groundwork for reform that starts with the institution of marriage. And he sees corporate implications in marriage, married, marital difficulty. So he relates it to church discipline. Though Farel's thinking on the nature of the family, true piety, and their relation to discipline were still in their infancy, his 1525 summary does show a connection between them. This connection is furthered a few years later in 1533 with a document called His Manner and Method, a document which would serve as the first documentary attempt at reform in Geneva. Well, on the evening of his arrival in Orbe in 1531, Farel confidently ascended the pulpit after Vespers, and as he began to speak, almost everyone present, men, women, and children, began to boo and to whistle. They hurled vile and offensive epithets at him with such a volume that it is reported to have sounded as if thunder were walking under the arches of the church. Farel was apparently accustomed to this type of reception, and he did not lose heart. But he kept speaking. He continued his speech with imperturbable coolness, one account says. But words, however, gave way to blows, and officials intervened to halt the growing riot. The next morning, Farel goes about preaching in the town square. He preached all day with hardly a listener until, for some reason, in the midst of his preaching, a mob of women rushed on him, began scratching at him and punching him, such that a local gentleman intervened with, "I beg your pardon, ladies, but I take this man under my protection," and hid him away. So the cause of reform seemed lost in Orbe, as the priests, the council, the citizens, all conspired together against Farel. They wanted nothing but for him to leave and to take his doctrines with him. but among the small cadre of faithful in Orb was a former student of his from his days at the University of Paris. The son of the town sheet maker and draperer, Pierre Verret, may have converted only a little more than a year previous, while in Paris, where he witnessed the burning of Protestant martyrs before fleeing back home. Farrell seized on Verret's faithfulness and pointed him toward the pulpit in hopes that a local might be heard in a way that a French foreigner in Geneva obviously could not be. Verret was only 20 years old. According to Charles Chenevier's account from 1835, he was of delicate health, slender and shy, with an extended voice. But in this fragile envelope was enclosed a strong and heroic soul with quick intelligence, a lucid mind fueled by a good education, a sincere commitment to the reforms, and a heart open to the inspiration of the gospel. He was indignant at what Farrell had endured, and though he was frightened by the idea, he himself decided to ascend the pulpit to preach his first sermon on May 6, 1531, in his hometown of Orb. Rumor spread throughout the city, such that a large and largely curious crowd was in attendance. His delivery was soft, though smooth and eloquent, and perhaps more importantly, uninterrupted. With their courage now bolstered, another local preached 4 days later on May 10th, and shortly thereafter, John Houllard, that former Catholic priest whose brother stood up in the middle of the service and cried out, "You lie!" to the Catholic Giuliani, also preached. On May 23rd, barely 2.5 weeks after Verret's first sermon in his hometown of Orb, they celebrated the first Reformed Lord's Supper in both kinds. On Pentecost Sunday, where each participant kneeled and answered to the question of whether they were willing to now forgive. But only a couple of months later, that impetuous Christopher Houllard gathered together a small band of believers to go to the cathedral and throw down the altar. The result was further tumult, only this time the tables were turned, with the Protestants being now the aggressors under the protection of Bearn. Battles ensued throughout the summer and fall, with, it is reported, blood flowing in the streets. Verret then negotiated a peace between Bearn and the people of Orb, an act which would mark his ministries in more ways than one over the coming decades. The conflicts in Orb and the tenuous peace that ensued illustrated for Verret that the Reformation would not spread effectively by sword, even if that sword was succeeded by a truce. Orb did not vote to support the Reformation until 1554, 2 decades later. True Reformation, Verret became convinced, would not come by imposition. It must be local. And that's a theme which surfaces in all of Verret's writings. It must be local. It must be pastoral as well as doctrinal. It must be fraternal as well as corporate. It must be marked by a genuine Reformation and piety. That experience in the small town of Orb marked every chapter of his life. The beginning of his ministry is primarily in Geneva. He follows Farrell's example and begins preaching tours throughout his native area of Vaud. Ends in Geneva, where he helps to begin the initial Reformation. He's there with Farrell. He's there with the debate. He's the main speaker in the debate with Guy Ferbity. After he leaves there, he goes to Lausanne, spends 20-some-odd years in Lausanne. Once he's exiled from Lausanne, he goes over into France, spends his final years in France. And every single one of these major divisions in his life, I think, is marked by his experience of what he learned those few months in Orb. Farrell's attempts to highlight the relationship between marriage and the community also should not be underestimated for its influence on Veret and the tone that he takes in the nature of his reform ministry. That an institutional arm of the church would intervene in private matters is certainly not unprecedented. But to link the authority for that with the community itself reflects an attempt to redefine the source of ecclesiastical authority. No longer shall the church and its officers intervene with inherent authority, but with derived authority, manifest in the community of faith and appropriated with pastoral intent. In Geneva, for example, this redefinition was a progressive realization, which in a seemingly contradictory development had its greatest materialization in the eventual consistorial authority to excommunicate, which consistories did not have outside of Geneva. My argument is that even that is an example of the desire of Farrell and Veret for a local, mutual reformation. It was a clear reappropriation of discipline away from the magistrates to those with ministries in the lives of the people. So a study of the consistory, you know, you're familiar with the consistory? The consistory being sort of the formal court of sorts where it became known as a court of morals. If one was accused of some sort of sin, they would be called before the consistory and kind of, it was the formal way of church discipline in much of the Reformed community. There were consistories all over, especially in Switzerland, the consistories that I've studied. Consistories in Bern, consistories in Strasbourg, consistories in Geneva, consistories in Zurich. You know, all the major areas around there had a consistory of some sort. The nature of that consistory, what it looked like, who was on it, whether it was lay, whether it was largely just the pastors from the area, the extent, all of that varied from consistory to consistory. But a study of the consistory and its various manifestations under Pierre Veret's influence is vitally necessary for any argument on Veret's views of ministry, accountability, ecclesiology, or even his politics. And it's his politics for which he is best known to most historians today. If you, secular historians in particular, would know of Veret because he was the first to articulate sort of a reformed understanding of the appropriateness of resistance to tyranny. When is it appropriate for a citizen to resist its government? I think even the study of the consistory and of Veret's ecclesiology explains that. Such a study provides insight into how Veret's theology evolved and matured through the various chapters of his life. It offers an opportunity to trace a longitudinal theme through his career, provides context. A study of Veret's advice and counsel on the role and purpose of the consistory in the life of a local church and its members provides opportunity to see in context how he relates piety to politics, ministry to the magistrate, liberty to authority. From the earliest days of his involvement in Geneva, through his middle years in Lausanne, and then on through his later years in France, evidence of his maturing ecclesiology is manifest in his recommendations concerning the consistory. And for Veret, the consistory and its polity were definitely matters of ecclesiology. So the argument set forth in this paper, then, is that the motivating purpose behind his evolving and maturing political arguments for which he is best known was essentially pastoral. And that Veret argued for an authority that resided chiefly with the people who constituted the local church. That's huge. You're going to be surprised at some of what Veret says about the nature of the local church here in a few minutes. Evidence for this is seen in each chapter of Veret's life and work, that the Genevan consistory was more rooted in pastoral concern, at least in its establishment, is evidenced by the preceding attempts to identify the corporate implications of piety and faithfulness with the responsibility for church discipline. And that the administration of those implications should be corporate, he argued. In order to accurately see this trajectory through his subsequent ministry and writings, a look at the mature form of his recommendations on the nature of the local church is in order. So what I'm going to do is show you what his mature ecclesiology was, what he argued about the church in its mature form, and then we'll come back and look at what he tried to establish in Geneva and see if it's consistent with that trajectory. I think it is. Verrey's thought on the nature and freedom of the church was clearly and certainly influenced by his frustration with Barron and its desire for authority over the churches and the entirety of the canton, which is like their state. That model was common to the Swiss, including the cantons of Barron and Zurich. But Verrey advised and argued against it early in the Genevan Reformation, and it was the cause of his eventual ouster in Lausanne. See, Barron wanted to have control over every aspect of the cities in its area. Control over the church. Freedom to dictate even the liturgy to the church. Verrey argued against that. Verrey and his colleagues there in Lausanne would go on strike periodically and protest to what Barron was wanting them to do. Verrey said, I don't want to be responsible for having unrepentant and potentially even unregenerate people coming to the Lord's table. I don't want to be responsible for that. So we want to have the freedom to be able to exclude them as a matter of discipline. And Barron said, no, you must do this. So they would go on strike. Eventually, it became the reason for his ouster after 20-some-odd years. And the outworking of his thought on what separates the church universal from the church local, Verrey argued that the latter is but a local expression of the former and should therefore strive to reflect the purity of its composition. Local churches, Verrey advised, should be communities of saints. They should strive for a regenerate membership. They should seek it by examining each applicant to the church for tangible evidence of genuine faith. This is language which is familiar to us, but was highly unusual to be articulated then. The decision about members belonged to the local church, Verrey argued, with little or no involvement or coercion from secular magistrates or even from an ecclesiastical hierarchy. Though he recognized the value of synods and ecclesiastical forms beyond the local congregation, he preferred local governance because any authority that a class or a colloquy, or a synod member might have came directly from the fact that he was elected by a local body of believers. In other words, his view of ministerial authority was that such authority was derived from the congregation and was not inherent in the office or the officer per se. He argued in a letter to the pastors of Montbéliard on the 3rd of May, 1554, that the freedom of a local church to govern itself extended even to the church's liturgy and ceremony. He further argued that the polity of a local church ought to be uncomplicated, representative, and quite similar to, and this is his word, a republic. The initial thesis of this research project was that there was an incipient congregationalism in Verrey's theology, and that this incipient congregationalism could possibly have even served as a precedent and forerunner to subsequent strains of English congregationalism. Well, the latter of these yet remains to be investigated, but the evidence for the former is quickly mounting. Congregational polity is certainly a part of Verrey's theology, perhaps even more than I had anticipated. In his 1554 response to Ropatel and in both his 1559 and 1564 Instruction Chrétienne, Verrey clearly excludes episcopal and hierarchical forms of polity as normative for church governance. Nor did he much hesitate to express his disdain for the magistrate's involvement in local church matters in a variety of writings, as well as in his decades of combativeness with Barron. Verrey describes the local church as a spiritual and heavenly republic. He describes it as a free city. Certainly the case here should obviously not be overstated. Verrey understood the realities of the political context in which he found himself, but he did not like them. As he and his theology matured, his view of the local church, the place of discipline as an essential mark of the church, his impatience with Erastian Baron, all grew with him. But never, however, should the case here be understated. Verrey's contribution to ecclesiology is not insignificant. And the characteristics which render his contributions considerable and substantial are those which in many ways exceeded the ecclesiology of his cohorts, even Calvin and Beza. His granular perspective of local churches is wed to his encouragements to individual piety and marital faithfulness. If things like marital faithfulness have corporate implications that the church must deal with through discipline, then the church must be local in order for the discipline to be effective, Verrey argued. His desire for the popular consumption of his encouragements to genuine faith and piety is seen in his use of what would now be termed dialogical pedagogy. His 1564 Christian Instruction contains one such dialogue between a supposedly fictional Pierre and a fictional Matthew. So I find it somewhat tedious to read Verrey when he does this, but he has these long dialogues going back and forth between fictional people, one playing the role of the straight man, the other the role of the idiot, usually. Pierre argues over the course of this dialogue that the local church is, and I quote, a free community which is called the communion of saints, and to which Jesus Christ has given all power and authority, not to anyone in particular, but to all in general, to be used by all for mutual edification in the church, and not for destruction. Matthew's response is, that sounds disorderly. How in the world could that work? Pierre continues, notice how the power and authority is given to all the community of the faithful, just like it is in the hands of the people in the popular state of what was in ancient times called a democracy. Nevertheless, it is not to be considered a fault of the church that it should by common agreement elect certain persons out of the body who, having a special charge, exercise and administer the public offices which are ordained of God in the same, as they do in a free city in which the elections to public offices are made by the bourgeois and the citizens. So do you see the analogy he's drawing? Who are of the same community. His mature ecclesiology argued that local churches ought to have self-governing authority in matters of membership, of liturgy, of ceremony, election of officers, administration of ordinances, the execution of corrective discipline. Perhaps execution isn't the best word to be used there. And ought to resemble a democracy. A phrase that we're probably familiar with, it's similar to a democratic authority. Dr. Wills here. He also held that church properties were the possession solely of the congregation. Each of these arguments appears to me to proceed further than Farrell, than Calvin, or even than Beza were willing to go. Some have claimed that Verrey, quote, shared in the characteristic reformational understanding of the nature of the church and its ministry. That is, in my view, a miscalculation of Verrey's significance. It may be true in a broad sense that includes things like the marks of a true church, but it does not account for those areas where his espousements went further than a characteristic reformational understanding. Certainly, Verrey's architectonic purpose was biblical fidelity, but the thesis here proposed is that the preferred application of his ecclesiology was pastoral. Manifest, for example, in his efforts to see lay involvement in the church, including in both corrective and formative discipline, and thus his evolving emphasis on an increasingly local consistory as well. in its final form, developed during his later years in France, Varey's recommendations concerning the consistory were for it to be composed only of those democratically elected by the church, including those who were elected to serve as ministers, who held indefinite terms of office, those who were elected to serve as deacons and elders, who preferably held single year-long terms of church office, with the ideal total size of the consistory only being 12 to 15 people. Which is intimidating enough. That was certainly not the shape the consistory took in Geneva, where he started, to which we now turn to begin testing this proposal, that the reappropriation of ecclesiastical authority away from ecclesiastical or magisterial hierarchies and toward a congregationally derived authority, seen in the importance of lay piety and formal mutual accountability, and we'll do so by looking at marriage and family as a test case. You see what I'm doing? We're going to test this idea that the reappropriation of ecclesiastical authority away from hierarchies and magistrates to the local congregation, evidenced by lay involvement and formal mutual accountability, thus the consistory, and we'll use marriage and family as a test case for it. Varey's redefinition of ecclesiastical authority would surpass even Farrell's own initial formulations. Though his thought on these subjects is preserved from a later period in his life, I think you can see them even in Geneva. Varey, building on Farrell, paved the way for an understanding of mutual accountability among the Genevan populace, a mutual accountability which operated under the oversight and guidance of the consistory. The ecclesiology which took form in Geneva under Calvin after Varey left is likely less than what Varey would have wanted, but certainly contained much that advanced his agenda for mutuality in ministry and lay involvement in governance. You realize the office of elder in Geneva was conspicuously lay until at least 1555? Of particular importance to the study of the office of consistory, or the consistory, is the office of elder. The ecclesiastical ordinances dictate that the elders were to, quote, keep watch over every man's life, to admonish those who they see leading a disorderly life, and where necessary, report them to the assembly, who would be deputized to make fraternal correction. The reappropriation of authority begun with Farrell and Varey in Geneva is evidenced even here, in that the Genevan office of elder was lay until at least 1555. So Calvin continued their trajectory of reform and instituted an ecclesiology which built on the desire of Farrell and Varey for a corporate accountability of genuine piety in the consistory, made of lay elders together with the company of pastors. This is further evidenced by the repeated description of the elders in 1541 in the ecclesiastical ordinances as representatives of the seigneurie rather than as ecclesiastical officials. And it's clearly indicated there that the consistory is not to be considered a court of justice. The purpose was the care of souls, the restoration of the sinful, the catechesis of the ignorant, the encouragement of the faithful, the reconciliation of the broken, and not merely the conformity of the insincere. Now, it may have become that, but that's not where it started. But for the prior efforts of Farrell and Varey, the eventual unanimous passage of the ecclesiastical ordinances establishing the Genevan consistory with the expressed right of excommunication would have been highly improbable. The immediate needs to which the consistory was addressed were explicitly identified. And this is their mandate that they were given. The reason why they were told to begin a consistory was to address, quote, evil living and marriage cases. It's directly descendant from the persistent emphasis of Farrell on the vitality of the family as indispensable to true piety, Farrell's 1525 summary and brief exposition and his 1532 manner and method are indispensable to a more fully informed view of the development of Genevan Reformation. Excuse me while I bend over. This book, in many ways, stole my dissertation, but I won't go there. Farrell has been overlooked, I think, for far too long. The role of his 1525 and his 1533 works for the nascent Genevan Reformation in particular has been overlooked for much too long. This book includes translations of parts of both of those documents, I believe. Early French Reform, the Theology and Spirituality of Guillaume Farrell, Jason Zwiedema, and Theodore von Ralty. Highly recommended. Excellent work. Excellent work. A librarian makes a book plug. Imagine that. Private piety and public good, whether civil or ecclesiastical, for Farrell and Verrey are inextricably tied, and this recognition drove them to reform the marriage liturgy as part of the first attempts at reform in Geneva. You also see the contributions of Verrey. Though Verrey's most commonly discussed contributions to the development of political theory are his ideas concerning religious toleration and the resistance to civil authority, his ideas on lay involvement in education helped to set the course of the Genevan disciplinary efforts in that the polity of the Genevan church would include two offices dominated by lay participation, one of which comprised an essential part of the consistory. Calvin's influence built on the reform efforts of Verrey and Farrell. And though the consistory eventually took a form more like that of the Bernese model than the Strasbourg model, which with Calvin would have been most familiar, Calvin's insistence on the excommunicatory authority of the consistory was a logical outcome of the pious ethic of reciprocity worked by Verrey and Farrell. So, some case studies. The Genevan consistory was regularly concerned in its early years with four main outcomes: the restoration of offending parties to right faith and conduct, reconciliation in relationships, responsibility and provision for the innocents, and creedal comprehension. Whether the issue before them was merely one of discord between family members or a severe case of fornication or adultery, the consistory desired to keep those four ends in mind. During the early years, 1542 to 1544, much attention was given to the content of the offender's faith due to the continuing effort to purge Geneva of the remnants of Catholicism. The early years of the consistory saw them dealing with a number of cases. People would be called before the consistory on charges of, you know, worshiping idols or praying to Mary, or of marital unfaithfulness and abuse, abandonment. In almost every one of these cases, however, the first thing the consistory would ask, especially in the early years, was, can you say the Lord's Prayer in French? And can you say the Creed in French? They all knew it in Latin, but none of them spoke Latin. And if they didn't know it in French, in their native tongue, they were told to go away and come back later once you've learned it. They were trying to get doctrinal truth and piety to be worked out in the context of the accusation before them, if that makes any sense. March 2nd of 1542 saw a candle maker. And usually in the minutes of the consistory, it'll give the name of the person being called as well as what their vocation is. And I'm horrible at pronouncing French names. I can read the French, but I'm horrible at pronouncing it. So, you have a candle maker. If you want to know the name, you can get my paper. It's on the back. He was questioned on why her husband was not living with her. Her reply indicated that he was in business in another town. The consistory then asked about her faith, of which she could give no explanation. She was then remanded to return 3 weeks later to show improvement, and to do so with her husband in tow, so that he could give an account of his faith as well. On March 2nd of 1542, a particular man and the daughter of another man in town were summoned to determine the state of his marriage proposal to her, The father would not grant his blessing on their proposed marriage to a baker, that's all we know. And after a rather confusing interview with all parties involved, several versions of the story having been presented, the consistory ordered that the marriage be denied, though the parents be urged to consent. The last line of the entry indicates that her mother be summoned to account for the content of her faith. So even if it was just a secondary person involved in a matter called before the consistory wanted to know the state of the faith of all involved. On March 16th of 1542, the consistory summoned someone to inquire about the rift between she and her son-in-law and concerning the whereabouts of her husband, with whom she was apparently not living. They remanded her to the following Thursday and summoned her daughter, her son-in-law, and her husband in order to sort things out. They were quite obviously concerned with reconciliation within the family, even if the family was not, and with the state of her marriage. Each of these typical and representative cases, summoned within short intervals of each other, illustrate the consistory's concern for the family. Peaceful family relationships, intimate marital relationships in which separation ought to be minimized, parental authority and responsibility in directing their children, and finally, and yet most pervasive in application, the consistory's perpetual concern for the content of faith for all Genevans, are each indicative of the nature of the work of the consistory, which they sought to exercise in those early years. The pastors of Geneva held marriage in very high regard, a commitment which reflected their treatment of all the matters before them related to the marriage relationship. In those early years, there were four things the consistory would typically do. Decisions that they would make if someone was called before them. The first was a pattern to remanding them to reappear. In other words, they'll hear sort of the facts of the case, ask some questions about their faith. If the married couple was separated, they would say, okay, come back in 2 weeks and bring your spouse with you. Oh, and by the way, learn the Lord's Prayer while you're at it. Remand them to reappear at a later date. They would remand them to the council. If there was something that they thought needed some sort of, it was a civil infraction, better for the council to handle because the consistory had no civil authority, they would remand them to the council for them to be dealt with legally. But second most common thing, second to remanding to reappear, was the command for them to frequent sermons. Even in violent cases of mistreatment, such as one particular person who was called before the consistory under the accusation that he had been beating his wife, he claimed that he had never hit his wife more than four times. In an apparent effort to reassure the consistory that his beating of her was not excessive, the consistory advised that they live together in peace and that they promised in front of the church that they would live together in peace and that they ought to frequent sermons. Certainly, mistreatment of the wife by the husband was more common than the reverse. But there is one amusing example in which one Hieronymy, on July 5th of 1543, was called before the consistory to offer an account of his wife's abuse of him by beating him with a rock and doing him great injury. That great injury, well, we won't go there. The consistory's response is illustrative of several of the patterns of action they frequently employed, but included twice among their admonitions here, in this particular hearing, for them to frequent sermons daily. It's nearly impossible to read the registers of the consistory without being affected in many ways. Many of the entries are records of broken relationships and tell tales of heartbreak and sorrow. Others are really quite humorous, even though some manner of impiety had prompted their appearance before the consistory. One such example provides another illustration of an admonishment to frequent sermons, that of Henri Philippe and his wife. They appeared together before the consistory on January 11th of 1543 because of mistreatment in their life together. They sometimes grew angry with each other, especially when Henri has lost something and cannot find it. And then perhaps in response to a question by the consistory, to elaborate on one such example of where he would get mad at her if he can't find something. They couldn't think of anything, but Henri's wife responded that, okay, I suppose I will not go drown myself in the lake. And they were admonished to frequent sermons and to live in peace. Another common admonition by the consistory, especially when seeking reconciliation between quarreling or estranged individuals, was the encouragement to live in peace and union, especially in cases of mistreatment. There was a very famous case, the first divorce case, between Pierre and Benoit Amyot. The second hearing of this case, which has been discussed at length in a number of places, ended with an extended admonishment for them to live in peace. Her expressed repentance from her aberrant views led them to encourage her husband to pardon her, and that they be reconciled with each other, and that he live with her peacefully. The consistory's genuine desire for marriage to be restored and nurtured was expressed as it applied the admonishment most directly to him, quote, and that he should accept her as his wife and treat her sweetly and amiably. The Genevan consistory was more rooted in pastoral concern than mere moral enforcement is evidenced by the preceding attempts to identify the corporal implications of marital faithfulness and the responsibility for the administration of these implications to be corporate as well. I'm running out of time, so let me just conclude. Ferré's contributions built on Farel and reflected his desires for a derived ecclesiastical authority in which all the church members have responsibility for each other. He established a theoretical precedent for the Genevan consistory's desired involvement in the exercise of formative and corrective discipline outside of the authority of the magistrates. He paved the way for an understanding of mutual accountability among the Genevan people, a mutual accountability which operated under the oversight and guidance of the pastors and elders rather than of the government. So the blood that flowed in the streets of his own hometown of Orbe that summer and fall of 1531 taught Verre much. His life of peacemaking and dispute mediation, for which he was called upon often, a number of times he was called from Lausanne back to Geneva to help mediate disputes. His fairness in the disputes between Catholics and Protestants in a number of places even saved his life a time or two. His desire for a reformation that comes not by imposition, but by the pastoral, fraternal, and local ministry of believers and the lives of believers, as seen even in his early efforts in Geneva. Is the trajectory he helped to set consistent with the prior emphases of Farel? I think so. Is it consistent with where he ended up in his mature ecclesiology? I think so. Taken with the limitations, the political limitations in which he was striving, I think so. So to conclude, I provide the following quote from the minutes of the Genevan consistory from October 12th in 1542, which appears the first matter of business in the presentation of church wardens. It lists the names of all of those who are being appointed. It says they are summoned to the consistory to establish order in the church. These are lay people. Order in the church by watching over those who live badly in their villages, and to conserve the Holy Church, to show a good example to those who wish to err in the church, and for the sake of the word of God, which should be well heard. And it being known that they are honest and peaceable and a good example to others, that they should admonish them along with the minister about the word of God, and see that the others do their duty. They are not to spare anyone, neither their families, wives, children, servants, or maids, at instruction after dinner. And they should remand those in error to the consistory, and those who retain papal superstitions from former times. They are to give good admonitions to tavern goers, blasphemers, and I love this phrase, other evil livers. Also who with anger and hatred for each other, and those who rebel against the word of God and the honor of justice as far as they can. Thank you.
Well, we have time for about 10 minutes or so for questions.
What did Calvin think about parades?
There were a lot of letters going back and forth between them. We don't have a lot of correspondence between them on specifically Vray's mature ecclesiology. Early when the Genevan ecclesiology was taking form, much of the work was done by Farel and Vray. And then during the exile, when Calvin left to go to Strasbourg, Vray actually left to go to Lausanne. And there was not a lot of communication back and forth about the establishment of the consistory. I think Vray was actually working behind the scenes to get Calvin recalled from Strasbourg back to Geneva. They disagreed on a lot, but I don't believe we have much record of correspondence on the nature of their disagreements. They were very close friends, very close friends. When Vray was exiled out of Lausanne, he went first to Geneva and was loved by the Genevans. More people attended his sermons than attended Calvin's sermons. And Calvin even made note, and I don't remember where he made note of it, but he made note that the house given to him by the Genevan Council was bigger and better furnished than his own. And he just sort of an offhand comment makes you wonder if he was a little bitter about that. So they were close friends. He was loved in Geneva. I don't know that there was opportunity for them early on to converse about Vray's developing ecclesiology, and we don't have a record of any correspondence from later in his life when he was expressing his mature ecclesiology. And there was a falling out, by the way, between Calvin and Vray on one hand, and Farel on the other. When Farel, late in his life, he was, 70 or so, and he married like a 16-year-old girl. And it was just scandalous. And here you have, and Vray thought it was horrible. And from that point on, there's not a single record of communication between Farel and Vray.
Any other questions?
I have not found it, but I have not looked yet. It seems to be the logical next chapter in his line of thinking. What he lays the groundwork for, what he is expressing, you find expressed in similar language in early English Congregationalism. I have not looked in depth yet at references back to Vray. Vray is usually appropriated during that time in two ways. One, for his political thought, not so much his ecclesiology, even though for Ray the two were tied together. And also his mammoth two-volume set of Christian instruction, which was printed in English in England in the early 1700s, I believe.
After the death of Calvin, there's a huge debate on this issue of church government, particularly in France and Paris. Ray obviously would side with those who opted for a congregational perspective.
Indeed.
And so he would have differences then with the man that we're about to hear from after a major break.
And perhaps perhaps Dr. Wright would shed some light on whether or not there was actually a rift between Vray and Beza. Some say that one of the reasons why Vray left Geneva after he was exiled from Lausanne and went to France was because there was a disagreement, a rift between he and Beza when Beza was clearly becoming the successor. I don't think that's the case, but I don't know Beza as well as Dr. Wright. So. Thank you.
We're going to break now till 10:35, so about 25 minutes or so, and then Dustin Benj will come and lead us in a short study of Calvin's prayers, to be followed directly by Dr. Wright speaking to us about the pastoral vision of Beza. There are copies of Paul's paper that have been distributed. There are also copies of Dr. Wright's paper that will be available during his talk. So, thank you.